I also begin by acknowledging and giving my respects to the Ohlone people. We're speaking here on their country. And it's kind of uncanny, I think, that it's often uncanny and interesting in panels such as this that papers might speak to one another without any planning at all. There might be echoes in what I'm about to speak in my paper with Philip's trope of the drone and contemporary technologies of cognitive and territorial colonization, and perhaps also Anne's your reference to Frederici and the quality of relationality. Because what I want to speak about today is how we might begin to produce or affect a decolonization of how we speak about Australian poetry. And rather than addressing the content of poems, I'll be speaking more about the form and the context of the poetry that's being produced in Australia at the moment. Now is the time for the decolonisation of Australian poetry and poetics. During the 20th century, the appearance and discussion of Australian poetry and poetics was cast in a series of sequential and overlapping phases that can easily be described as the colonial, the modern, the postmodern, and the post-colonial. Amidst these phases, discourse about Australian poetry cycled through groupings and categories such as the late Romanticism of Charles Harper, the queer and revolutionary modernisms of Lesbia Harford and Mary Fullerton, the intersection of symbolism and modernism in the work of poets such as Christopher Brennan, the differently cast nationalisms of the Lindsays and the Jindy Warabacks, for instance, the post-war modernist classicisms of A.D. Hope and the pacifist environmentalisms of Judith Wright, the generation of 68 and its curious blend of postmodernist experimentation and romantic self-consciousness, and more recently, I think, to echo Ron Silliman, the Antipodean renderings of cosmopolitan post-avant rhapsody and the plodding introversions of a homegrown school of quietude in Australia. So generally speaking, 20th century Australian poetry bloomed amidst the what I think of as the heavy folds of a mantle embroidered with threads, gleaming with the imperial and the romantic, the patterns and styles of which were invariably and quite obviously borrowed from the cultural centres of England, Europe and the United States. So I wish to speak of a 21st century Australian poetry and poetics that properly addresses the legacies of imperial romanticism, unfastens and perhaps remills and sometimes opaque and corroded lenses of 20th century critical apparatuses, and which speaks something of the truth about what's happening now in contemporary Australian poetry and what it is and what it can do. To this end, I wish to bring to bear a discourse of decolonisation as a central element in the renewed perception and recognition of contemporary Australian poetry and poetics, and how we might adapt a discourse of decolonisation into our discussion of experimentation and innovation in Australian poetics. In fact, decolonisation speaks to the post-postmodern, the post-postcolonial, the nascent contours of a 21st century sensibility that radically recasts the conditions of the imperial, the romantic, and the colonial, and which reveals new ways of speaking to the materialisation and expression of Australian poetic language. In Australia, we no longer need to speak of the post-colonial, which many of us have always understood to be neo-colonial. But rather, we need to begin speaking of the decolonial and start imagining or reimagining the poetic nature of a decolonised Australian imagination. So the purpose of this short paper is to invite thinking and discussion about work I've been doing recently in proposing a fundamental demarcation between two modes of poetic thought and production, which I define here as the extractive and the proliferative. I'll speak about these in more detail in a moment, but briefly I propose that an extractive aesthetic aligned with the colonial, and indeed in some cases the post-colonial imagination, seeks to create a poetic object in which poetic value is formed by the coercion of poetic substance from nature, culture and labour, and its inflation in neo-colonial economies of poetic exchange, which are fundamentally aimed at reifying what might be described as an imperial ego. The proliferative, on the other hand, is intrinsically decolonising, as it creates poetic value by multiplying threshold events in networks of relation and complexity, rather than being coercive, extractive and inflationary, and which are aimed at maintaining and sustaining local autopoetic formations in poetic language. I'll be addressing a set of key recent works, including the Protosea chapbook that I produced for Cordite in 2013, responding to ideas of the artist John Wolseley, in poems by Stuart Cook and Natalie Harkin, and more recent poems by the very overlooked contemporary Australian poet Louise Crisp, and also the very well-known contemporary Australian poet Michael Farrell. If I have time, I'll also be drawing a comparison to Les Murray's Inside Ayers Rock from Subhuman, or we might say Subterranean, Redneck Poems. But firstly, what does it mean to speak of a poetics of decolonisation? What do I properly mean by a poetics of extraction or a poetics of proliferation? In a recent issue of Social and Political Thought, Emma Battelle-Lohmann and Lucy Maybland suggest that routes toward decolonisation are textured by the differential vectors of the post-colonial and the decolonial, and how they each differently imbricate the colonial and, indeed, modernity itself. These critical frameworks have been reasonably well rehearsed in recent years, especially in the work of theorists such as Walter Mignolo and others such as the Caribbean philosopher, novelist and poet Edouard Glissant, and more recently in the work by many theorists in areas such as in the environmental humanities, Elizabeth Dalloway and Ursula Heiss. Especially following Mignolo, decolonial thought can be understood as a mode of critical theory with a Marxist genealogy that forms responses to the formation of imperial nation-states and imperial or colonised subjectivities that, in the literary sphere, perform or are subjected to colonising poetic practices and objects. As Lohmann and Maybland point out, the decolonial moves beyond frameworks established in the late 20th century by theorists such as Said, Barber and Spivak to contemporary work that critiques coloniality and modernity from within. They write that Mignolio's signal achievement was his realisation that decolonisation starts with the recognition that there is no modernity without coloniality. Coloniality is constructive of modernity and is not derivative. In some senses, it can be argued, as Lohmann and Maybland wish to emphasise, that the modern traditions of the Western Academy that emerged during the 500 years of the European Enlightenment coincided exactly with the assertions of colonial imperialism and its totalising, globalising imperatives, which systematically suppressed indigenous ontologies and epistemologies. The task of a decolonising poetics, therefore, is to critically recast the DNA of the modern in a manner that can disclose non-imperialised indigenous and non-indigenous sensibilities and their expression. So I'm proposing here that as part of our critical armoury in the work that we do in experimental and innovative poetics, particularly in the Australian context for us, that we can imagine a new set of critical apparatuses to help effect such a recasting. Although, of course, there are numerous ways in which this can be done, and I'm simply proposing one possible vector, a rubric that defines an extractive versus a proliferative aesthetic goes some way to achieving such a goal. In this rubric, I'm focusing specifically on the creation of poetic value. An extractive poetics produces poetic value through the coercion of poetic substance from the world, like the extraction of raw materials from nature by extractive mining and their refinement into objects for profitable exchange. An extractive aesthetics or poetics develops value by subjecting nature and language to forms of poetic labor in which the valuable poetic objects are refined, accumulated, and exchanged. This might reference what you were saying before, Anne, about contemporary cultures of accumulation and exchange, in prize cultures, for instance. Indeed, as occurs in mining and resource extraction, the extraction of poetic value involves at least two forms of extraction. Firstly, the material extraction of more raw material from the earth, but also the extraction of human labour from human bodies, and the classical intermingling, following Locke, of matter and labour into a form of exchangeable property. This is the colonial mode, the colonial project built upon the imperial projection and extraction of value from nature, the primitive accumulation of wealth. Thus, for instance, in the contemporary phase, in some quarters we witness the fetishistic relation to craft, poetic craft, and the cherishing of particular forms of poetic labour over forms of poetic relation. In poetic terms, a poetics of extraction therefore follows a similar totalising logic aimed at the accumulation of aesthetic value in propertied and exchangeable poetic objects. The poem is valued more as an artefact in an economy of aesthetic closure in which, for instance, the refinement and inflation of the labour of the imagination produces neo-romantic authorial property rights which intersect with the neo-colonial sublime. Conversely, a proliferative poetics creates value through the multiplication of relation, rather than the extraction of value from poetic labour and matter, the senses and cognition, the creation of a poetic object for exchange. A proliferative poetics is generative rather than inflationary. A proliferative poetics produces networks of complexity and correlation and correlation, which manifest and embody poetic value in matter, sensation, and cognition, cohering as threshold events rather than as exchangeable artifacts. Imagine, for instance, networked solar arrays rather than the internal combustion engine. The energy of the cosmos appearing naked and real for a time, shimmering. Ontologically, we might speak of points of coherence in the intersection between art and matter, emerging as folds or lines of condensation between matter and thought in the creation of poetic substance. I'd like to think more about how that might connect with a kind of Bergsonian sense of duration and an Olsen-esque sense of proprioception. But I haven't done that here. Now, in 2013, I curated a project for Cordite called Protosia, which was responding at first to the work of the Australian artist John Wolseley and his paintings, which were responding to the separation of Gondwana, the ancient continent, into the southern parts of Africa, the Australian continent, and South America, and the fact that in these, in particular ecological zones in these places, particular plants share DNA and but separate forms of evolution. So basically came from the same place, but then have evolved separately in different parts of the world. Profound geo-aesthetical encounter reminds us of an embedded planetary and genetic inheritance that, despite the complexities of our technologies and linguistic apparatuses, is always and unescapably experienced in common. Indeed, this is the deepest of the commons. The shared information, geological, biological, cosmological, and cybernetic, that is central to our core relations to the Earth and indeed to each other. Gondwanaland is a temporarily opaque but profound precursor to our core existential relation to place and others. It inflects a human commons and a politics of speciation, the deep unfurling and substantiation of both organic and cultural form. Now, Wolseley produces his art by what he calls frottage in nature, a proliferative, what I would describe as a proliferative frottage, taking his works into landscapes and leaving them for many weeks while they are inscribed by processes of movement and inscription by the landscape itself. Such a practice I think corresponds to particular modes of poetic production that we're seeing emerge in Australian 21st century poetics today. In the poem Mewani or Yam, Louise Crisp creates a relational poetic object that is really quite explicitly non-extractive. The poem synthesizes a network of correlations between place, poetic language in both English and Ngarugu language of the southern high country of New South Wales and Victoria, and botanic and bioregional histories of the same region. In this poem, and others in her recent work, including her book Uplands, published by Five Islands Press recently, Crisp is developing an ethically attentive, proliferative attention to place that creates experimental and innovative poetic objects that refuse to extract or coerce value from the world, but rather produce aesthetic value in networks of linguistic and other forms of correlation and indeed common ground. Around the undulating land of the Monero chocolate lily, nodding chocolate lily, yellow bulbine lily, pale vanilla lily, tubers, small vanilla lily, bluegrass lily, creamy milkmaids, yellow star, tiny star, yellow rushy lily, twining fringe lily, common fringe lily, early Nancy, golden moth, orchard valleys, carpeted with flowers and rich grass, mountain golden moth, orchid, purple diurus, leopard, orchid, tubers, tiger, orchid, parsons, bands, slender onion, orchid, etc. I think in that type of poem we're seeing obviously forms of experimentation and innovation that are adapted from familiar modes of experimentation and innovation in Western avant-garde poetics. But also, I think, and this is what I'm trying to add to our discourse about such poetics, a proliferation of connection, a proliferation of relation and networks of relation that produce a threshold event semantically and ontologically. Similarly, in Stuart Cook's Magpie, the branch, and in this kind of poem, for instance, we can see a very clear attention to 20th century modernist and postmodernist approaches to form. But again, if we draw a relation between an extractive and a proliferative engagement with or attention to nature and relation, there's another way of speaking about form here. Equally, in Natalie Harkin's Heart's Mill Projections, a work written in response to artworks by the Aboriginal visual artist Ray, whose work was projected onto the Heart's Mill in Port Adelaide, Stop the Gap, Mind the Gap, International Indigenous Art in Motion in 2011. And this is just an excerpt from that. We see a very attentive engagement with modernist and postmodernist form, but simultaneously a proliferative ontology and epistemology that creates a new set of relations, or how we might think about relation between poetic language and content. So a proliferative poetics and its revealing of threshold events is, I think, intrinsically part of how we might begin to think about decolonising Australian poetry and poetics, and how we speak about Australian poetry and poetics. In the Australian context, a proliferative poetics can be aligned with an Indigenous aesthetic which also rejects the extraction of value from country and its inflation in economies of exchange, but which rather emphasises the maintenance and sustenance of material, social and poetic systems in modes that are far more resilient, I should say, than those that have emerged in the wings of Western modernity. Systems of relation, reciprocity, kinship, and indeed lawfulness. Thank you.